Aristotle gave us four causes. Remember that? Who can remember them without looking at your notes? Mr. Kimball was not even here last time, and I bet he can give them to us. Go ahead, Mr. Young.
Formal.
Material.
Efficient cause.
Efficient.
And final.
That's very good. Even more than that, Mr. Young just knocked me over this morning, at the beginning of the day, by offering his solution to the question that I left hanging in your minds last time. Who remembers the question? The last burning question. And I said, you should think about this nonstop for the next week. And Mr. Young did. Which simply means he needs to get a life. But Mr. Perkett, what was the burning question? Do you recall?
Well, it was during the Reformation, the statement, by faith alone.
Yes.
By implies a Caucasian.
it's a whole new angle on the Reformation.
Racist. I knew this school was racist.
Anyway, we'll be doing a little editing of the transcript here. Please, go ahead.
Okay, so that the word by implies a causation.
Yes.
We wanted to know in which cause was faith being used.
Yes, that's exactly right. We talked about the various aspects of causation reflected in Aristotle's four causes, and then we were talking about the Reformation, which says we're justified by faith alone. And Mr. Young came in and just knocked my socks off by giving not only a good answer, but in fact the correct answer. So Mr. Young, I can't do it better. You want to explain your thoughts here for the rest of us?
Well, I mean, I read a lot, too. The idea was that when we say by faith alone, that we're talking about the appropriation of salvation. So they talked about a cause that's kind of a sub-cause that they call the instrumental cause. Mm-hmm. And the instrumental cause, it's a bit like if you were to say, what was the cause of this meal? Well, you might say, well, the material cause was, you know, whatever, the meat and the vegetables and whatever. But in order to appropriate a meal, you need a knife and a fork. And so that would be the instrumental cause. Mm-hmm. So the idea was that faith was the instrumental cause. And in that... If you assume that the formal cause is the divine plan, that nothing else can happen if you don't have the formal cause, that everything else flows from the formal cause and flows from the divine plan. So even the instrumental cause, is flows from the divine plan. So
right.
It's not as though that's not also a gift.
Yeah.
So that,
good.
That's kind of it.
The Reformers put the instrumental cause as a subpart of the efficient cause.
So we could not have gotten this answer from the list that you have up there. I see how it works.
Yeah, that's right. It was a trick question. But it was a problem, and they wrestled with it. And the sort of metaphor that they would use here would be that just as the sculptor uses tools, hammer and chisel, so God uses faith. So it makes faith something that God himself is working in us. That idea, of course, that leads us immediately into some theological implications that are kind of beyond the immediate scope, but that's the way they treated it. So you can, as the guy, who was the guy that said, put that in your pipe and smoke it? Who was that?
Probably Ben Franklin. He said everything.
I know, he did say everything, but I think it was Nightingale. It was a Nightingale or something like that. Anyway, that's his idea of causation. We were working through Aristotle's distinctions, substance accidents, form and matter, causation. I'm not going to deal with the categories. That would be a lecture all by itself, and it's really beyond the scope of what we need to worry about. So I'm going to drop to the next little heading on your outline, which is his epistemology. And I'd like to treat that briefly. We talked about, here's what we would cover normally under epistemology, his idea of induction and deduction. But you will recall last week we actually did a little snippet on that, right? We did the syllogism, we talked about how even a deductive reasoning process will usually depend on an inductive process to come up with those premises. So I wasn't going to say much more than that at this point, so that's covered. I'm thinking efficiency, you know, so. But you remember that, right? So the one thing we haven't talked about under epistemology would be his use of language. And this is a pretty important part of Aristotle's contribution, so I think we need to mention it. When Aristotle is considering how we do science, L-A-N-G-U-A-G-E. Two G's, you know, and the first time in my life it dawns on me, language has two G's in it. Look at there. When Aristotle is thinking about how we do this scientific, observation, classification, and so on, obviously language is the tool we use. And as he thought about language, it occurred to him that we use language in at least three different ways. And each of them has a somewhat different kind of color to it. And the three ways, I'm assuming somebody in here knows what these three uses of language are. Anybody want to take a stab at this one? You know, Mr. Kimball, do you where this is heading? You'll all recognize it once I say even one of them. But I just wonder if off the top of your head, anybody?
Maybe verbal.
No, that's not it. Good thought. Good. Yes? No, no, okay.
Metaphysically?
No. No? Okay. Well, that's getting there. Here's the three uses. First one is called univocal, or sometimes pronounced univocal. So now that I've greased the skids here.
Equivocal.
Equivocal is right. And the other is? Buddy? Unequivocal. There you go. Analogical. I learned it univocal, and then I learned later that really sophisticated people say univocal. But I keep, yes, that's right. That's exactly right. So I will.
Easy.
Yeah. So I will tend to say univocal because that's what's in my learning. And if you prefer the other, that's fine. What is univocal language? What does that mean? Mr. Dowers, you know that word. What does that mean? Univocal language.
One voice, one meaning.
One voice, one meaning. Absolutely right. So, I use a word to describe two different things, and I mean basically the same thing as I apply the word to two different objects. I look outside. I notice the sun is still shining. It is, right over there. And I say of the sun, it is bright. Then I look in here and I look at these light bulbs and I say, they are bright. And while there's a difference of degree, I mean basically the same thing, don't I? The sun is brightly shining, the light bulbs are brightly shining. That would be univocal use of language in which my meaning hasn't changed. Right, easy enough. Equivocal is when I take one word and describe two different objects and my meaning changes radically, although it's not utterly different. It's just a very profound difference of meaning. So I am being equivocal. So I look outside, I see the sun, it's bright. I see these light bulbs are bright. And then I look at Mr. Dowers. I know I've got many volunteers in the room, but and I say, and that Mr. Dowers back there is really bright. Now, what do I mean by that? do I mean that if I run a little experiment, shut off the lights, that the room is illuminated by Mr. Dowers?
Well, no.
No, that's still univocal there, right? So now, Mr. Dowers, the meaning has changed, and in what sense is there still a contact between the first use of bright and the second use of bright? Since you're the bright student here, in what sense is there still a kind of contact between those two meanings?
It's illuminated.
That's right. With your brilliance.
I'm not exactly sure.
Okay. Ms. Garfield, what would you say to that?
You had a
knowing look on your face.
Well, it does have to do with revealing.
Yeah.
So.
There you go. Right. Go ahead, Mr. Fugit. You were.
Oh, I was going to be right along there.
Okay. So, yeah. So, anyway, I say that student is a bright student. And what I mean is that bright, in a sense, like the sun is bright. But the brilliance is understood a little bit differently. Lights things up, explains things, makes things clear. So we can say that the word bright is being used equivocally. Right? There's a point of contact. If you drew a Venn diagram, you'd say the two uses of bright barely overlap, but there is at least a little bit of contact there.
So when you hear the word unequivocally, is that the same as... univocal?
Yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, it is, usually. If I say, I want to say this unequivocally, I'm saying I want to say it so that there's no variation in the meaning here. And yeah, you might say, but you don't hear people normally, I'm going to say this univocally.
Oh, I am. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So. Now, analogical is somewhere in between. So Aristotle is saying that when you use analogical language, it is doing a little more. There's more similarity than you would have with equivocal, but less than you would have with univocal language. You know, change the word, we'll use the word good. So, you know, what is good? Who owns a dog? Mr. Palpin, is your dog a good dog? No, that doesn't help me much.
Who has a good dog?
You've got, okay. Ruth has
a
good dog? He's a Dalmatian. Well, that
explains. No, Dalmatian. A little 4-year-old told me the other night, you've got a Dalmatian.
A Dalmatian. I've never heard of that species. All right, good. Well, you butcher dog, you are insisting, for our present purposes, is a good dog, right? Is that correct? Okay. And so, describe for me what it is about your dog that makes your dog good.
He's well-mannered.
Well-mannered? And what does that mean? Describe that behaviorally.
When you open the door, he waits for you to go in before he goes in, so he doesn't...
That's better manners than most of the guys around here. This is ruining my whole deal here, you know. Anything else you want to add?
Let's just say he's highly trained.
Highly trained, all right.
How much do you charge to train it, though?
He came trained.
So your dog comes when you call him? Her? Him or her?
Him.
Him? Doesn't bite the mailman? Housebroken? Anything else? That kind of thing, right?
Affectionate,
right? Okay. So, we have a word good, and as soon as we apply the word good to the word dog, immediately a definition of good sort of springs to your mind, doesn't it? Something like what Ruth was saying. The word dog substantially affected what you thought of when you heard the word good. So then if I turn around and say that, you know, Mr. Wright is a good man.
Comes when he's called.
Housebroken. You know. Doesn't bite the mailman. And you know what? Notice what happens. The word good is kind of morphs, doesn't it? As soon as I attach it to a different word, There's not a huge difference, but there's some difference in meaning. I redefine the word, and I do it without even thinking about it. The word itself is sort of attached to the object and changes its meaning based on the object. So we can talk about good dogs, we can talk about good men. Now, what happens if I say, our God is a good God? See. Now, again, the word changes, doesn't it? Changes pretty substantially. Not utterly, but in some sense or other, we understand that I can't say God is good in the same sense that I say Mr. Wright is good, but there's some proportionate change in its meaning. And that's what he means by analogical. The meaning of the word changes proportionately with the thing being described. That make sense? A proportionate change. Yeah, go ahead.
Adjectives are used more analogically?
Well, it's easiest to illustrate with adjectives. But it's the whole use of language. Okay. But I think the best way to get a feel for it is to think in terms of, you know, adjective. I might add, just jumping ahead a little bit, this is something that Thomas Aquinas picks up on. And he uses the same distinction, and the argument he makes is that we need to understand when we talk about God, everything we say about God is analogical. We don't speak of God univocally. We would have to be God to use language adequate to the task of describing God. I would have to be God to describe God and use language adequate. So we use human language. Here is a reality that's this big, and I'm having to use words that are that big. Human words that work just fine to describe Mr. Wright or dogs or other stuff. But all of a sudden, when I try to project that word and apply it to the deity, I should be very modest and appreciate that the size of the word is not adequate to the task. It cannot carry that freight. And so it's an argument for appreciating that everything we say about God has to be sort of qualified by its humanity. Or to put it another way, everything we say about God is anthropomorphic. It's all in the form of our humanity. And that's an argument for being a little modest. And it's also an argument for this is another way of saying the same thing, for not getting too proud of the language we use. Yes?
It just struck me when you used the word, that is so appropriate that Christ is
yes.
The word. He can be nothing else.
That's right.
We have no way of communicating
yeah.
To God.
Isn't that great? So the word became flesh, you know, the great anthropomorphism. Here he is. The Hebrews got this probably better than we do, because they didn't fall into the trap that we in our Western Greek use of language tend to fall into of thinking our words are doing more than they're doing. So we use really fancy words like God is omnipotent, you know. Of course, that's not all that fancy to this crowd, but you know what I'm saying. It sounds like a pretty big deal word. God is omnipotent. I had a student once. Students like to do this, you know. This was not here. I think it was at Whitworth. No, it wasn't. It was way back at the Bible school. This kid comes in with an attitude. And he goes, do you believe God is omnipotent? Yes, duh. God is omnipotent. Well, if God is omnipotent, he can do anything. Do you know what's the next question? Can God... That's right. Can God, we'll put it this way, can God build a rock so big that he can't move it? And you immediately think you've created this huge dilemma, you know. Because either way you answer the question, God is all of a sudden not able to do something. And now that's the kind of problem we get into because we use words and we think those are univocal words. We think that omnipotence has said more than it can say. It's just another anthropomorphism, you see. Now, the Hebrews didn't bother with that. So they'd say things like, God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. Nobody wonders if that's anthropomorphism. You know, it just is. Nobody hears that and thinks, oh, God is a cattle rancher. And, you know, he has 1,000 hills. Nobody thinks that way. You hear it and immediately you know that that is analogical language. God is not a cattle rancher. He's not going to have a shootout with the devil at the OK Corral. Nothing like that's going on. This is a way of describing God in human categories, and it's meaningful to us. But then in our Greek pride, we say, oh, no, we can't talk that way. We have to say God is omnipotent. And we don't appreciate it. That's still just as anthropomorphic as was the cattle on 1,000 hills. That's why in some ways maybe poetry is a better language for theology than all our little neat cut-and-dried categories of this and that. See the idea? Anyway, Aquinas makes that argument. And for now, I'm just kind of anticipating that. When we get to Aquinas, Lord willing, we'll come back and give that some thought. All right. Last thing I want to say about Aristotle is under the heading of theology. No, I lied. It's the second to the last thing I want to say about Aristotle. We do have one final one there, his ethics. We talked about Aristotle's God last time, pure actuality, no potentiality. Remember that? So when we made the form and matter, distinction, that kind of came up. Well, Aristotle gives these theistic proofs, which, again, were picked up by Thomas Aquinas. I don't want to get to Aquinas, but just mention these. There are several of them. There's only three that I want to mention here. So Aristotle is saying he believes that there is God, and he believes that that is necessary rationally. He doesn't think this is a God that we need to worship. It's not a God with whom we necessarily have to involve ourselves in any sort of, you know, personal relationship. That would be foreign to his thinking. But he believes as a matter of pure reason, we must postulate that that God is there. And so he gives then his theistic proofs, and there's several of them. I'm not going to mention all of them, just three of them, just so you get a feel for how he does this. One of them is the well-known teleological argument, which is what? What's the teleological argument, Mr. Fugit, our resident apologist? What's the teleological argument for the existence of God? It's late in the day.
I know it is. Purpose, yeah, there we go.
Thank you. Yeah. The argument from porpoise. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, there you are. Good, thank you. So, give me an example of a teleological, anybody, of a teleological, by way of example, what might be something you would use on an atheist? It would be an argument from purpose.
Why are you here?
Pardon me?
Why are you here?
Okay, yeah, sure, you could ask it that way, kind of the I'm thinking of something more in terms of just, you know, it's the idea of design in the universe. I've had this conversation with somebody, you know, you say, consider the human eyeball, you know. You realize that as much progress as we've made in technology and cameras and stuff, the most sophisticated camera in the world is still a piece of junk compared to the human eyeball. It is so astonishing how it functions, you know, how it works. And so you have that argument, and you say, you know, how can that happen except there was some kind of purpose? So Aristotle has an idea like that. He sees purpose, what he calls telechy, in the world. He sees things have purpose. He says, you know, I see it in nature, I see it in myself, I see it in the whole world around me. In fact, the only way I can recognize chaos when I see it is because I'm so accustomed to purpose. Purpose is really what's going on. And chaos is only recognizable because it seems to be not purposeful. You know, it's just, I'm surrounded by it. And so his teleological. Anyway, that's one. Another one that he uses, he doesn't use this term, but I'm going to use this term, the argument from entropy. He calls it the argument from motion. And he actually has two different versions of it. But it's the idea that as he looks at the world, he sees things in motion. He sees things moving. And he knows that things do not move unless there is something moving them. They don't just move spontaneously. You know. And he also notices that when things are in motion, they tend to come to a point of rest. I have a marker. I'm going to try a little experiment here, see if it still works. I'm going to cast the marker across the room, and we will see if it goes forever or stops. And once again. Oh, okay. Well, you'll have to trust me. Things don't speed up by nature. They slow down. And he notices that if everything's been around forever, that everything should have come to a complete standstill by now. You know? And it hasn't. And so something somewhere must be moving things because we still see motion. You know. Now we may not see the mover, but we certainly see irrefutable effects of a mover. And he knows that you've got one of two ways of dealing with that. Either there is an infinite series of finite movers, which is absurd, or there is one mover back there who is unmoved. And then there must, and so that's Aristotle's unmoved mover, right? So everything's moving because somebody somewhere is standing still and pushing. And so that's called in Christian circles the cosmological argument or some form of it. But Aristotle actually gave the same kind of argument here. The third one is an argument from what's called necessary being. Necessary being is more this idea. I notice that something exists, you know. Now, I cannot be sure that you exist, Ms. Holland. You may be a Fig Newton in my imagination. I don't know. You know. But even if you are an illusion, an hallucination, I cannot know for sure that you're there. I may have a beautiful mind that simply thinks you're there, and you're not. The one thing I can't doubt is that at least a hallucination exists, you know. Something exists. Something rather than nothing exists. You see what I'm saying? And if something exists, even if it's a hallucination, even if it is only, as Descartes says, that I am because I'm thinking, and so I can't deny that at least I'm here, thinking about the fact that I'm here, then if something exists now, then by necessary deduction, something must have always existed, the way he reasons. Otherwise, you've got a problem of a point where there was nothing, nothing, and then there was something. You know? And that would be absurd, because out of nothing, nothing comes. Not out of nothing, something comes, you see? And so if something exists now, something must exist eternally. And that's basically the argument from necessary being. If anything exists now, then something must have existed forever. And then he traces that back. And, you know, so the point is, and he has others as well. I'm just trying to give you a flavor. Because again, Thomas Aquinas picks these up and sort of recomputes them into what are called the five ways, in which he argues from kind of natural reflection for God's existence based on these so-called kind of, rational proofs. And that has been a quite controversial discussion because there are those who would say, well, those rational proofs don't really work because all they ever lead you to is Aristotle's God, which is an idol. And so there are those out there who would say we shouldn't use those because they just lead us down a dead-end street, you know. Others would say, well, even though Aristotle's God is an idol, it is true that Aristotle's God shares something in common with the true God, namely, he's the creator, namely, he's always existed. Those things are true. They're not exhaustive in describing God, but they're not false because they're not the whole story. So there's a great debate, and it is the debate, friends, if you're tracking with us, between classical evidentialism and classical presuppositionalism. You know, so there's the kind of where the battle line is drawn on that great debate. But that's a little beyond our scope right now as well. But anyway, you see, all of this kind of goes back to some things that Aristotle was toying with and Thomas picked up. Fair enough? One more chapter on Aristotle. Go ahead.
Do you think Aristotle would have held to, like, the ex nihilo creation?
No.
And out of nothing came?
No, he didn't. Yeah. I know that Aristotle did not maintain that, and that was a real dilemma for Thomas, who wanted to use as much of Aristotle as he could, because he was using it, and we'll get to this eventually, but Thomas Aquinas was fighting Islam, and Islam had made a lot of progress using Aristotle. So in a sense, what Thomas wanted to do was use Aristotle against the Aristotelian experts of the world to prove the Christian faith, you know. So he wanted to make Aristotle as serviceable to Christian thinking as he could. But the one place where he choked was where, well, several places, but one in particular he choked was on that point. Aristotle believed that God exists eternally, but because of the nature of God, God must be eternally creating. So God, in a sense, can't help it. The fact that he's there, by the nature of the case, means he's always creating the universe. He's always the unmoved mover. And so he doesn't have any idea of an original creation. When I used ex nihilo up here, I was simply saying that the very fact that there's anything existing at all must suggest that there's something that's always been there. That's the way he reasons. Does that get to that answer your question? Yeah. All right, last thing is his, again, I'm just giving you a little snippet of this one. His ethics, of course, again, is worth a full separate discussion. But he does have this interesting little scheme. For him, ethics is inseparably related to happiness. So ultimately, the virtuous man is going to be the happy man. Not happy in the sense of going to a theme park, but happy in the deepest sense of that profound idea that I am in a state of well-being. The sense Jefferson meant when he talked about the pursuit of happiness, you know. This deep sense of satisfaction with my existence. And so he talks about what it is that provokes happiness. And this has given rise to this little classic set of definitions of happiness. And now, again, I wonder, is this something you come across? It's kind of a neat... I'll tell you, the first person I ever heard present this was Father Spitzer from Gonzaga. And I'd never come across it before, but it's part of his Nicomachean ethics. Have you ever come across this?
Four definitions of happiness?
Well, yeah. Now, I know there's some that he... Go ahead. What are you thinking of?
Well,
yeah.
The Junior Rhetoric includes four definitions of happiness. He has that in his rhetoric book.
Okay, and it may be, I think I heard that once and they were a little bit different. So go ahead and tell me what you have in mind there. Yeah, yeah.
One is like? Freedom.
One is like?
Not exactly.
That's right.
Prosperity and the freedom of joy.
Okay, these are. I think he spells it out a little bit different in his ethics, because I remember having that conversation with a student once. Anyway, here are the four. I'll start on the bottom and work up. The lowest type of happiness, he says, is pleasure. I had a wonderful experience of this a couple of days ago because I overheard Ellen Faniff saying to Kara Brockett, not realizing that I, of course, have keen hearing. Oh, don't worry about it. Mr. Gore's tests are always easy. So she says that kind of at a whisper level, you know, to and I was all, Ellen! You know, and, oh, she was mortified. And then she's just falling all over herself because she just, you know, she's just absolutely, because she didn't mean for me to hear that, and she was kind of being tongue-in-cheek, but I didn't give her any peace about it. I was just ruthless. Well, so much for, you know, I mean, I just really gave her some grief. I didn't know. So the next day she comes in with a plate of chocolate chip cookies and an I'm sorry note taped at the time. And then I felt terrible. You know, it's like, I didn't mean for it to go that far. You know, I didn't mean that she had to bring me hecatombs, peace offerings. So anyway, but I did nevertheless eat the cookies. You know, wasn't above enjoying this. And I experienced pleasure. I experienced a certain degree of happiness because I love chocolate chip cookies. I do. And so I eat them. And as I eat them, something inside me just, it's like Augie Doggy. Remember that cartoon way back then? None of you are old enough to remember that, but I do.
I am.
Okay, Mr. Williams remembers. Now, what's the problem with happiness predicated strictly on physical pleasure of any kind? What's the problem? If I decide I'm going to pursue a life of just being happy by finding all the physical pleasure I can, like chocolate chip cookies or anything else, what's going to happen, Mr. Dykstra?
Yeah, I was just thinking that cookies go away. It's just sad.
Okay. Well, let's say that I have an endless supply of them. You know? Then what happens? What happens there, Ms. Woodruff?
Caloric intake.
Caloric intake, yeah. What did it, go ahead.
You get fat.
I get fat.
They lose.
In fact, if I eat, think about it, if I eat one cookie, it's wonderful. What happens on about the 15th cookie?
Vomit.
Yeah. It's painful. It becomes painful. And that's called the hedonistic paradox. And that's true of any form of purely physical pleasure. At the beginning, it's wonderful, but if I keep pursuing it, I will inevitably wind up in a state of pain. You know. So Aristotle appreciates that there's a certain kind of superficial, temporary, transient happiness that I can experience with chocolate chip cookies or any kind of physical gratification. But he also knows that ultimately it creates this strange dilemma that I'll usually wind up in greater pain than the pleasure, unless I can discipline myself, eat two cookies and then stop, you know. Beyond that, I start running a risk. So he says there's a more profound level of happiness beyond this, and he says beyond just simple pleasure is the happiness that comes from, anybody know? You might almost guess it. From, I'll just say it this way, winning. The pleasure of victory. I sit down with Cam Berglund and propose a game of chess. Cam's a pretty good chess player, you know. And so if I play him and win, how do I feel? I'm happy. How does Cam feel?
Zaddy.
The more likely outcome, of course, would be just the reverse of that. I'd play Cam, and I'd be the one upset. The problem, he says, with the happiness from winning is more profound than the happiness from pleasure, but you always run the risk of losing, and in any event, it is always a zero-sum game. The experience of pleasure I gain from it is always going to be at the expense of somebody else, right? My pleasure at someone else's expense. I can have happiness, but my happiness is always going to depend on somebody else being on the opposite end of the teeter-totter kind of deal. I did that for the first time just this past weekend. We went down to the playground at Pasadena, and there's a big old teeter-totter there, a little seesaw. I haven't done that in 50 years. All my grandkids were on one end, and I was on the other, and I held them all down. It was kind of scary. But, all right, beyond winning, the next one. This one you should know, because Jesus taught it. Close. You're very close, but he's a little more practical than friendship. What?
Giving.
Giving, yeah. Notice giving is not a zero-sum game. If I give, you know, a Christmas card to somebody, I feel good. And the person who receives it feels good too. They may not feel as good as I do, because it's more blessed to give than to receive. But both sides get a benefit. Nobody's a loser when you give. And so Aristotle figured that out. Not bad for a pagan. If you live a life of giving, especially true altruistic giving, giving where there's really no possibility of getting something back, it's not a simple exchange, but it's true heartfelt giving, especially to those who can't pay it back at all, you will feel happy. And it will be a deep and lasting happiness, he says. But he says even that doesn't quite get to the highest level of happiness.
The development guy would argue with that.
That's right.
I don't know what the first one is. That's right.
You could probably use this, you know. You could just get rid of the first one and you're set. All right, the last one, he called it the great cause. He said that finally the greatest, deepest sense of happiness you'll experience is when you can attach yourself to some cause, a noble cause that is much greater than yourself. You know, when you sense that you are involved in something that has lasting influence, effect, purpose, far beyond your own little contribution to it, you will have the deepest sense of happiness. It's not bad, I think, for, you know, concerning a guy who is, as far as we know, not informed by any kind of biblical perspective, it's not bad.
You can use that, Dale.
I can use that.
Yeah,
I
that's
think
right.
We got one and two.
Yeah, actually, I've used it. I've talked to students about it. I said, you know, I practiced law for 20 years. I don't think I ever, whether I had a case and won or lost, I don't think I ever had a sense I was connected with a great cause, ever. I might be connected with a cause. It might be a virtuous cause. Somebody's been injured. They need representations. Fine. You have some sense of, you know, performing a service. But I've never had a sense of great cause, really, like what I've had when I've been here. You know, I wouldn't swap it. Because I feel like, you know, someday I'm going to be gone. Someday we're all going to be gone. But I bet the Oaks is still going to be around. You know, some of the finest institutions in the country started as very modest little enterprises. 200 or 300 years, who knows? Maybe the Oaks will be the great institution in America. Why not? You know. And to believe that we're all making a little tiny contribution to this, you know, possibility, it does kind of fill you with a sense of happiness, purpose. You know, I think Aristotle could say it even from his pagan perspective. How much more can we say it from a Christian perspective when we have a sense of God's building his kingdom, God's doing these great things in history? God, you know, I mean, how much more can we kind of appreciate that? So anyway, this is a little bit random. You know, these are just kind of areas where Aristotle made a contribution. And I actually was intending, I think I'm not going to do it. I knew this might take two sessions to really do Aristotle, and so I've been a little bit more leisurely. Won't be quite this leisurely as we go along. I'm not going to give you my next handout. We'll save it. This is Hellenistic philosophy. It's the Stoics and the Epicureans, who are the people Paul ran into in Athens. You recall Acts chapter 17. But I wonder if you'd rather just kind of like to talk about Aristotle, engage in this a little bit more conversation, please.
Yeah.